Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it is Tuesday, February 2nd, and we're going to have a lecture on cells today. It's going to be really similar to what you already know in anatomy, so I might skip over a lot of stuff in your notes, but nonetheless, you still got to know everything that's in your notes, right? Like what the organelles are, the names of them, how to recognize them by structure, and since they have a different structure, what would be your guess? They got a different function, right? Okay, and then we're going to talk about mitosis, but you know a lot about mitosis already, but I'll try to review some key concepts for you, all right? But before we get to cells and organelles, we're going to start with something that's even smaller. What's smaller than an organelle? And refer to maybe one of the first things you learned in anatomy, and that is the structural hierarchical organization of living things, okay? So, if you have a cell, what's a building block of a cell? Organelles. Yeah. And what's the building block of an organelle? Molecules, right? So, chemistry. So, we just got done with chemistry. So, I want to review some of those molecules that you might see on the test, for instance. And I think we started doing this last time. All right. So, I'm going to go through this twice. First time, not too fast. Second time, I'm going to speed it up a little bit because I don't have a lot of time. All right, so here we have a nucleotide. And what kind of nucleotide? Ribonucleotide, right? And you should know the various pieces right here. Okay, so then what is this right here? Sulfhydryl group, right? If there are amino acids that come together, they can form a disulfide bridge that will be a very strong stabilizing influence on a protein when a disulfide bridge is formed between two parts of a protein chain. Amino group, carboxyl group that makes a molecule acidic. It also makes that end of it hydrophilic, right, because that one proton can jump off. Phosphate. Right, so that's also a very powerful kind of group that allows something to dissolve in water, right? That's a hydrophilic moiety right there. Okay, then we have a monosaccharide. How would you make a disaccharide? What's the chemical reaction you would use? Dehydration synthesis reaction. Saturated fatty acid. And this is a triglyceride formation via what kind of reaction? Three dehydration synthesis reactions, right? At these three positions on. And what's the name of this molecule here?
Glycerol.
That's glycerol. So you should be able to tell me what the building blocks of a triglyceride are. And what are they? One glycerol and three fatty acids. Yeah. All right. All right, next molecule. Monosaccharide. That's a micelle. You should know what the building block of a micelle is, namely their phospholipids.
Steroids.
Yeah, so these are steroids, and what class do they belong to? Yeah, it's a lipid molecule. Unsaturated fatty acid. Amino acid. Phospholipid. Okay, you see the phosphate. Here is a glycerol with two fatty acids, and then here is the hydrophilic head group that symbolized by that big sphere right there. Prostaglandins. What class of compounds are prostaglandins? They're lipids as well. Okay, what is that? Yeah, the structure is an alpha helix, but in terms of the hierarchy of protein structure, it is secondary structure. What's the building block of secondary structure? Primary structure. Yeah, we're going to look at that today. Deoxyribonucleotide. What's the basic building block of RNA and DNA? What's the building block of DNA and RNA? They're going to be nucleotides, but remember there's two kinds. The DNA is made up of deoxyribonucleotides, and RNA is made up of ribonucleotides, right? So nucleotides are to DNA and RNA as amino acids are to proteins, okay? hydroxyl group. Glycerol. Phospholipid. Carbonyl group. Ribonucleotide. All right, we're going to go a little bit faster. Ribonucleotide. Ah, okay, I just went back and forwards because I want to go in the same direction. Okay. Sulfhydryl group. Amino group. Carboxyl group. Phosphate group. Monosaccharide. Saturated fatty acid. Yeah, triglyceride synthesis. Monosaccharide. Micelle. Steroid. Unsaturated fatty acid. Amino acid. Phospholipid. Prostaglandin. Alpha helix, her secondary structure. Deoxyribonucleotide. Hydroxyl group. Glycerol. Phospholipid. Carbonyl. Ribonucleotide. Sulfhydryl group. Okay, one more. Amino group. All right, so I don't think I'm going to go over this again unless everybody wants me to go over it maybe at the end of class or whatever. All right, but you should be looking at some of that. And I made a video of this that's on a website someplace, either my website or Blackboard. I forget where it is. All right, if you want me to find it for you, I'll find it for you. Okay, so you shouldn't miss any of those on the test, right? Right. Okay. All right, so we're going to go over chapter 3 today. So what do I need to do? Pointer options. Arrow options. Okay, so basically this is just a chapter on cells. Here's a picture of a generalized cell. It's probably not such a good picture as what you find in your anatomy book, all right, but it's not bad. And it's a building block for something. It's a structural and functional unit of something, and I want you to know what it is a building block of. What is a cell a building block of? It's a building block of life, right? If something is alive, it has to be built out of cells. That's all there's to it. So there can be a number of processes that look like living processes, but that process is not a living process unless it's contained within a plasma membrane. All right, so there's got to be cytoplasm inside that plasma membrane, and there's got to be genetic material as well in order for it to be deemed a cell. Okay, so we've got plasma membrane that defines the exterior world or separates the exterior world from the interior world right here, and inside the cell you have cytoplasm. Okay, and your book probably doesn't have the most modern definition of cytoplasm. Cytoplasm has two components to it. It's got the solution, right, the fluid part inside the cell that has enzymes and molecules dissolved in it, plus, and we call that cytosol, plus it has organelles. So cytoplasm has those two components, cytosol and organelles, right? And so what we see right here are various organelles inside the cell. All right, so we got the nucleus, that's an organelle. Right, that contains the genetic information, contains the chromosomes, and it protects the chromosomes. When a chromosome is being used to make a protein, it's in a very vulnerable form. It's in a very long, thin filament called extended chromatin. And that thread could snap, and when it snaps, that would be like you having, well, you don't have these things anymore. Like if you had a tape, all right, like a videotape or music tape, and the tape got cut, well, you couldn't play that tape anymore, right? So if that DNA gets damaged, then the cell dies. So that DNA is protected by the nuclear envelope right here under most circumstances. The active part of the nucleus is the nucleolus. That's the part that's making RNA. RNA is another kind of nucleic acid, which we're going to talk about today. All right, some other organelles that we see inside the cell, just surrounding the nucleus, kind of forming around it, is another membrane-bound organelle. And when I say membrane-bound, it just means that there is what? A membrane that is making up that organelle or surrounds the organelle. So you could classify all of the organelles that you see here as either being membrane-bound or non-membrane-bound. And this right here is what we call endoplasmic reticulum. And it's a system of membranes. And in particular, it's a special kind. There are two kinds of ER. This one is rough, meaning that it has these little dots that make it look like sandpaper. And these little guys right here are ribosomes. So the function of a ribosome is to make a protein or protein synthesis. So rough ER is responsible for making certain kinds of proteins. Right, we see ribosomes in other parts of the cell, in the cytoplasm, okay, or in floating in the cytosol. Those are what we call free ribosomes. They make proteins as well. But the difference is the proteins that are made by rough ER are going to be given to the Golgi apparatus, and then the Golgi apparatus is going to modify those proteins, might conjugate them with another kind of molecule, like a sugar molecule. So it will be part protein, part sugar. We call that a mucopolysaccharide or a glycoprotein. And after the Golgi modifies it, it packages it into this vesicle, and the vesicle moves over to the plasma membrane, and it is secreted outside of the cell. So proteins that are made by rough ER have a fate such that they will become extracellular proteins. Proteins that are made by free ribosomes in the cytosol here are going to remain inside the cell, so their fate will be intracellular. So protein could have two possible fates. It could be extracellular or it could be intracellular. If it's extracellular, it's produced by this secretory pathway starting with the rough ER. If it's going to be intracellular, it's made by this free ribosome. So the ribosome is the workbench where proteins are made. All right, so if you're going to tell me one word for rough ER, what are you going to say its function is? Protein synthesis. Yeah, protein, well, two words, sorry. Protein synthesis, one concept, right? Protein synthesis. Those proteins then go to the Golgi complex or Golgi apparatus, same word. What's the function of the Golgi apparatus? Two concepts maybe you should think of. Modification and packaging into secretory vesicles right here, okay? And what's the function of a free ribosome? Yeah, protein synthesis for proteins that will remain inside the cell. They're not going to be packaged into a secretory vesicle. All right, another very important membrane-bound organelle is a mitochondria right here. And you can see it's kind of shaped like a bean. It's got a number, it's got another membrane on the inside, so it has a double membrane system. These folds inside the mitochondria are called Christi. And this complicated organelle has a function of, we're going to spend a couple of weeks looking at just this little guy right here. It makes ATP. All right, so it makes, it's important for ATP synthesis. And what the heck is ATP good for? It's the energy molecule that's going to power our bodies. We get energy inside our bodies by eating all kinds of food, right? Proteins and glucose, sugars, lipids, right? And then it's the job of the mitochondria here to convert all of that energy into an energy form that is utilizable throughout the cell, and that's ATP. Mitochondria need a compound from our atmosphere to work. All right, and it's the reason why we inhale. Why do we inhale? What's that molecule that we are inhaling that mitochondria are going to gobble up and make ATP in the process of? And that is oxygen, right? So mitochondria need a fuel molecule like glucose, but they also need oxygen in order to make ATP. We're going to spend a lot of time looking at that. Mitochondria also have their own DNA molecule. It's not inside a nucleus, but it's floating inside the mitochondria right here. And mitochondria control their own replication rate depending on a number of factors. One factor might be how much ATP this cell needs. It can replicate itself. And when you look at this mitochondria right here, it has the same size and shape as a bacterium. Okay? And you could consider could you consider mitochondria a living substance, something that's alive? What are the characteristics of something that's alive? It's got to have a membrane, a cell membrane, genetic material inside of it, right, and cytoplasm. And a mitochondria has all of those characteristics. So you could actually think of a mitochondria as being a separate organism from the cell, right here, and it's a generally accepted theory right now, and that theory is called the endosymbiont theory of mitochondria. And that at one point in time, there was a cell very similar to the human cells that did not have mitochondria, and they were infected by bacteria, right, and a special relationship developed between the human cell and, not a human cell, but a kind of a precursor to an animal cell, right? The special relationship developed between that invading bacteria and that cell, to which they both got some benefit from each other. So what's the benefit of this cell from having mitochondria in there? What does the mitochondria produce? ATP. Yeah, and so that can fuel the living processes of the cell. Right? But since it's a symbiosis, those mitochondria, those bacteria that invaded, got something beneficial as well from the cell. Can you think of what's the benefit to the mitochondria of living inside of a cell? Well, what would happen if there was an ice cream bar sitting on the table right there? Well, I would eat it. Okay? And if there are bacteria around in the world, there's other bacteria that will eat them, or other organisms that will eat bacteria, paramecium, for instance, right? So when the mitochondria is inside of a human cell, guess what it has? It has protection from everything else that wants to consume it, right? Your whole immune system is there not only to protect yourself, but everything that's alive inside of a cell. We call that the endosymbiont theory. Endo meaning inside. Endosymbiont. It's a symbiont that lives inside of us, and we both get something out of the deal under most circumstances. Okay? All right, so that's a very interesting organelle. It's membrane-bound. There are also microtubules inside the cell right here. Microfilaments as well. They provide for the cytoskeleton. They can attach to the plasma membrane. They can pull and push on the cell membrane. They can define the shape of the cell. So if we were thinking of an epithelium, how many different shapes, generally speaking, can an of a cell of an epithelium take? Yeah, three. You got squamous, you got cuboidal, columnar, and it's the cytoskeleton that gives that cell its shape. And then there's some really special cells that are shapeshifters, and they can actually crawl around inside your body by pulling and pushing on these microtubule systems that deforms the membrane. We call that diapedesis, when a white blood cell is crawling around inside of your body. Organelles that help organize the cytoskeleton and control these microtubules are the centrioles right here. Centrioles are non-membrane bound. Okay, there's no membrane around them. They act as anchor points for the microtubules, but also direct the activity of microtubules. Another way you can think of a microtubule is that it's like a railroad. Okay, it's like a railroad track or a road where other organelles can hop on and go to different parts inside the cell. But there's not two of them, there's only one. So where have you been on a train that only has one rail? Really close. Disneyland. Like Disneyland. What do we call that? Special rail. That's a monorail. So you could think of the microtubule system as a monorail system inside the cell where various organelles can hop a ride and move around inside the cell to get to different points. Right? Or maybe the nucleus is directing where these organelles go. Because remember, these vesicles right here have to move from the Golgi apparatus to the plasma membrane, and the way that they move could partly be due to diffusion, but also partly because it's being translocated along this system of microtubules. Okay, so what else do we see? There's some other vesicles inside the cell, and I can't really distinguish, maybe you can, the difference between this lysosome here and secretory vessel. Can you tell that there's a difference? One's a little bit darker, okay. Maybe it's a little bit different color. Maybe not, okay. You have, yeah, I have no clue. Okay, you have four kinds of vesicles that I want you to be aware of. You have the secretory vesicle. What's the function of that secretory vesicle? It's transporting some kind of product to be secreted from the cell, right? A lysosome is not involved in secretion. It's an intracellular digestive system. So a lysosome has lysozyme inside of it, and lysozyme is a digestive enzyme. So it can break things down. So if there's a complicated protein, and your body wants to recycle those amino acids, it can end up inside of a lysosome, and lysozyme will break a protein down into its building blocks, namely amino acids. Via what kind of reaction? A hydrolysis reaction. Hydrolysis reaction. And so now you got amino acids, and what can your body do with those amino acids? It can make whatever protein that it wants or needs from those amino acids, because it's just a basic building block. All right, so that's two. Secretory vessel, lysosome, which is a digestive system. You also have a peroxisome. And a peroxisome has peroxidase in it. And peroxidase is important for detoxification. All right, so peroxisome detoxifies toxic compounds that this cell will make, all right, in its normal process of living. All right, but you don't want those toxic compounds to build up. A peroxisome will detoxify it. And then lastly, there are things called endosomes. Endo meaning something inside the cell, a vesicle inside the cell. And an endosome, you're going to have to wait a couple weeks till we talk about them really, but they contain components that can fit into the plasma membrane and act as a reservoir for those proteins. And when an endosome fuses with the plasma membrane, maybe like we see right here, then those membrane components that are in the endosome become part of the plasma membrane. All right, so a good way to think of an endosome is for routing. It will take something, put it in the plasma membrane, or it can take something out of the plasma membrane, some structures out of the plasma membrane. And when those structures are placed in the membrane, guess what happens to the function of the membrane? It changes function. Or if those structures are taken out of the plasma membrane, what happens to the function of the plasma membrane? Yeah, it changes again. So you could think of that as a switch, as turning processes on or off by inserting or taking them out of the plasma membrane. That would be the job of an endosome. All right, another kind of endoplasmic reticulum right here does not have ribosomes on it. So what could be the function of that endoplasmic reticulum? Could it be for protein synthesis? No. Because why not? No ribosomes. So this kind of ER is made for making lipids, right? So lipid synthesis, you would say. What would be your favorite lipid? Okay, some people said steroids. Yeah, that's good. Phospholipids, that's good. All right, all those are good things. Okay. So let's see, what did I miss here? Maybe not too much. All right, not too much. All right, well, let's look at the building block of a membrane. Okay, or let's look at the structure of a membrane. And it could be a membrane, the cell membrane, or it could be a membrane around the mitochondria. This particular one right here is actually a zoomed-in region of the plasma membrane. All right, so we're going to look at some small part of the plasma membrane right here and magnify it maybe 1,000 times. Maybe 10,000 times, all right, maybe more. All right, so let's just look at this small area right here, and how many layers does it look like you see right here? What kind of repeating structure do you see over and over and over? Okay, I see a phospholipid layer here, and I see another phospholipid layer right here. So that's one way to think of a membrane, is that it is a phospholipid bilayer. Right, so that's not a very sophisticated way, but that just describes the basic internal, the very simple internal structure of any kind of membrane. It's a phospholipid bilayer. Sign and sheets going around. All right, so what is the interior? What's the nature of the interior of the phospholipid bilayer? Is it hydrophilic or hydrophobic? It's hydrophobic. That's where all those fatty acid tails are poking up into, right? So this region right here is drastically different compared to the outside surface or inside surface of the plasma membrane, which is hydrophilic because why? Because you got that phosphate head group right there. That is hydrophilic. All right, so there are lipid molecules that can dissolve in this interregion, the inner region of the plasma membrane. And here we have a cholesterol molecule. Why is cholesterol comfortable dissolving in this region right here where I have the cursor floating around? because it's a lipid as well, right? Lipids can dissolve in lipids. All right. So think of the phospholipid bilayer as something that's very, very fluid. And maybe you played around or somebody you saw somebody playing around with a bottle of soap, and you can stick this little hoop inside the soap bottle and bring the hoop out and wave it around in the air. And what does it make? It makes little bubbles. You know, those bubbles can float around because that film, that soap film, is very, very thin, right? And if it's a really big bubble, how does it float? Does it float like a big basketball, or what's it doing? It's undulating around. You know, if you kind of wave at it, then it really deforms and floats around, okay? So that soap bubble film is very fluid. And as a matter of fact, if you have two bubbles, if they touch each other, sometimes they pop, but other times, what happens when they touch? They actually form a bigger bubble. They don't pop, right? Because the film is exactly the same on both bubbles, so it can fuse together to form a bigger bubble, okay? So that's the concept I want you to think about in terms of the phospholipid bilayer. It's very fluid, right? And you could maybe think of it as a film of oil on the surface of water. So if we put a drop of gasoline or oil on water, all right, it's going to just float right on top. And if you shake that container, what's going to happen to that film that's right on the surface of the water? Is it going to undulate with it, or is it going to fracture and break like ice on a lake or something? It's just going to undulate with it, right? Because the basic that oil film is very, very fluid. Same thing for the plasma membrane. It's very, very fluid. It's so fluid that if you didn't have these other structural supports like cholesterol within the plasma membrane, if you stood up, you probably would just drip out on the floor. That's probably an extreme example. All right, so the plasma membrane, its basic nature is very fluid, but there has to be things added to it to give it some structure. All right, and cholesterol is doing that job partly. Other structures that can be added to the phospholipid bilayer to give it other kinds of functions, right, might be these proteins right here. Okay, and these proteins can have a number of different functions. Sometimes a protein that's in a membrane might have an enzyme associated with it, maybe on the outside or inside surface. Right? Another kind of protein might actually act as a receptor so that signaling molecules from other cells can trigger this protein to change activity inside the cell. Right? So it could act as a receptor. An enzyme. Other proteins have these compounds attached to them. These are sugar molecules. You see carbohydrate right here. Notice you have a certain branching pattern associated with it. So every cell has these glycoproteins on it with a particular branching pattern, and each of us in here has a unique pattern of those glycoproteins. Right? Some of us are like this, others are like that. Right? They all have a little bit different pattern. And that's what identifies a cell as to whether it belongs to your body or not. All the cells in your body will have the same branching pattern, but if we take some tissue from another person that has a different branching pattern and puts it in your body, what is your immune system going to do? Yeah, it's going to kill that cell. It's going to reject it because it knows that it doesn't belong to you based on those carbohydrate chains have a different branching pattern, right? So those things we call antigens. So antigens are placed on the surface of the membrane poking out to the outside world, and that is a little identifier or an address of that cell saying that it belongs to you. Okay. So let's see, we got, oh yeah, enzymes, receptors, identity markers. What did I call identity markers? Antigens. Antigens are identity markers based on the branching pattern. And even more important, or just as important, I forgot to mention this, so I'm glad I looked at this slide. Okay, some of these proteins can act as transporters or channels in the membrane. All right, so when we look at this membrane right here, we see the basic structure is a phospholipid bilayer, but a more sophisticated understanding of the plasma membrane, right, is what we call the fluid mosaic model. So it's a model that you should have in your mind to describe the plasma membrane. It's fluid because why? Of the phospholipid bilayer, but it's also a mosaic because of all these different proteins or glycoproteins or glycolipids that can be inserted into the plasma membrane to give that plasma membrane other kinds of functions, right? So it's actually a puzzle made up of all different kinds of pieces. Phospholipid bilayer is the simplest way to think about it, but fluid mosaic system is even a better way to think of it. And when you think of mosaic, think of enzymes, receptors, antigens, and transporters that will allow molecules to move from inside to outside the cell or from outside to inside the cell. All right, so maybe I'll just say one last thing. There are some molecules that can move across the plasma membrane, and there are other molecules that can't. So what is this internal part of the membrane? Is it hydrophilic or hydrophobic?
Hydrophobic.
It's hydrophobic. Right, so the only kinds of compounds that can get across this barrier right here are hydrophobic compounds. All right, things that can dissolve in oil can move right across the plasma membrane. Other kinds of compounds, right, that are hydrophilic cannot move because this is a barrier. It's a permeability barrier. So can anybody think of a compound that is hydrophilic, something that can dissolve in water? And let's just see if it can move across the plasma membrane. Potassium, that's an ion. And as a matter of fact, potassium cannot move across this plasma membrane, the phospholipid bilayer, because it just can't get through this lipid area right here, this hydrophobic area. But at certain times, you're going to see potassium does move across the membrane one way or the other. And the reason is because there is a transmembrane protein with a hole through it that will allow potassium to move through it, all right? And some of those, and we call that a channel, some of those channels will have a gate. That means that sometimes that channel is open and sometimes the channel is closed. And that means that the structure of this protein is going to change, which then means that the function of that protein is going to change, and it's going to change the function of the cell when that channel opens or closes. Okay. Let's talk about bulk transport of large particles or large amounts of material that's in solution. Okay, so we see that this cell right here is actually changing shape. And why can this cell change shape? Because the microtubules are pushing and pulling on the plasma membrane, right? That requires ATP to do that. And so it's pushing out the plasma membrane. It can recognize this particle right here. And here's a white blood cell that is going to surround this particle. We see it in two dimensions, but it's going to surround this particle in three dimensions. And so after this particle is surrounded, where is this particle really existing? Here it's in the extracellular space. But after it's completely surrounded, where is this particle? Inside the cell. Okay, so it's going to be, this is a process called endocytosis, bringing material inside the cell. And if it's a solid particle, we call that phagocytosis or cell eating, right? Cytosis is a cellular process. Phago just means to eat, right? A solid particle. But if it's just a solution, maybe of glucose molecules that are dissolved in solution, that endocytotic process is called pinocytosis or cell drinking. All right, so that's when material enters the cell. In every case, this bulk transport requires ATP in order to happen because it's got to move all these membrane components around. Okay. So the two processes of endocytosis are pinocytosis and phagocytosis, right? Okay. There is an opposite, a process that we call exocytosis, and we talked about that already, and that is when material is processed by the Golgi apparatus and put in secretory vesicles. That secretory vesicle is going to fuse with the plasma membrane, and then whatever in that vesicle is going to be released outside the cell. Right, so that's the secretory process, and we would call that exocytosis. Okay, on that nice picture of a cell that we have right here, there are some organelles that are not shown. Your anatomy book shows a couple of them. And they stick off of the plasma membrane. Some maybe are about this long. Okay, and they're just foldings of the plasma membrane, and they don't move around. They're just there. They increase the surface area of the cell, and those are what we call microvilli. So microvilli are processes, small processes sticking from the plasma membrane that increase the surface area of the cell. And the reason why we want to increase the surface area of the cell, because that increases the absorption. That increases the doorway for material to enter the cell. So microvilli are important for absorption. So where might you find cells that have microvilli on them? Yeah, intestines. Perfect example, because you want to absorb nutrients. Okay. Other cells have processes that are a little bit longer, maybe go from here to here. And these have more microtubules that can slide up and down, which cause these processes to bend. Right? And a cell might have 100 of these processes that are all bending in the same direction. And we call those cilia. And those that cilia, none of the cells in the human body move by ciliary action, by cilia. But since they're sweeping, it can sweep the extracellular fluid over the surface of that epithelium. So the function of cilia is motility, not directly of the cell, but of the fluid that the cell is being bathed in. Okay, or mucus, for instance. If there's mucus on a lining that is ciliated, that mucus is going to sweep in one direction when the cilia beat. Can anybody remember a part of your anatomy that is ciliated? Okay. And the trachea, that's exactly what I was thinking. Okay, there are other areas like fallopian tube, for instance, but trachea is a really good example. The trachea is lined with ciliated cells. Matter of fact, it's what? It's a pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelium, right? And all those cilia are sweeping mucus. And where does that mucus come from in that epithelium? What's that unicellular exocrine gland? A goblet cell. Yeah, it secretes mucus onto the lining of your trachea. The cilia are sweeping up, so all that mucus, and the job of that mucus is to trap dust and dirt particles so they don't end up in our lungs, and then that mucus ends up in our throat, and then what do? Look, then we just swallow it down, right? Get it out of our lungs. Unless you are what?
A baseball player.
Yeah, unless you're a baseball player, then you just spit it out. Okay. All right, so bottom line, function of cilia is? Motility, right? Motility. Unicellular organisms, there's a vast number of unicellular organisms that can swim around in their environment by using cilia, but our cells don't have to do that. There is one cell in the human body that can swim around. Not because of cilia, but because it has another membrane component that's called a flagellum, which might be about 15 or 20 times as large as a cilium. I don't see it on this diagram right here. Okay, but it's a free living cell, and it can swim around. Which one is that?
Sperm.
That's a sperm. That's right. It can swim around all over the place. Okay, so what's the function of a flagellum on a human cell? Motility, once again. Right. Okay, so that kind of talks about these slides right here. Oh, there, that's nice. All right, so you see a nice picture of cilia, and it's got arrangements of microtubules inside there so that it can sweep and beat. Okay. Let's see what we got. I talked about the cytoskeleton already. Different dyes can be used to reveal the cytoskeleton inside the cell. So it's used for positioning organelles, right, for maintaining the cell shape, various things. All right, so I want you to be able to recognize an organelle by its shape and then tell me what its function is. All right, now what kind of organelle did I miss right here? I think we talked about all of them already. I think so. Lysosomes we talked about. Peroxisomes we talked about for detoxification. So at least you should know one word for the function of each of these organelles. Golgi apparatus, know two, modification and packaging. Okay, so here's that nice mitochondria where we see the Christi membrane on the inside. Right here's the outer mitochondrial membrane, the inner one. And so here is the intermembrane space, the space interior or deep through the inner mitochondrial membrane. We call that the matrix. And we're going to look at the chemical reactions that happen in each of these different chambers. All right, so here is a ribosome, the tiny, tiny dot that we saw on the cell. And so what's the function of this guy right here? Protein synthesis. And a ribosome is made up of some proteins, but it's mostly made out of RNA, and a particular kind of RNA, namely ribosomal RNA. There are two subunits. Maybe you can see one subunit right here. It's kind of a lighter color, and then there's another subunit over here, which is a darker color. And these two things fit together, and they can come apart, okay, and then they can go back together. And when they fuse together, it leaves a tunnel going through the ribosome. And this is a tunnel that a messenger RNA is going to move through like a thread. All right, we're going to talk about different kinds of RNA and what they do for the cell. All right, so rough ER is protein synthesis. Smooth ER is lipid synthesis. We talked about that secretory pathway already. Okay, we also talked about the nucleus, namely that its job is to protect the DNA from everything that might be happening inside the cytoplasm. So you could think of DNA as being the blueprint on how to build your body, but it also contains information on how your body should function. All right, so it controls how your body functions. So if that, you could think of it as a computer program. If you corrupt the computer program and you boot it up, how's that computer program going to operate inside your computer? Not very well. Who knows what it's going to do, right? It just might crash. Same thing for this DNA inside the nucleus. If it becomes corrupted, that could cause the death of the cell. So it's protected behind this nuclear envelope right here. All right, so DNA is used to make proteins. So let me tell you how I think of DNA inside the nucleus. DNA makes chromosomes. It contains the blueprint on how to make your cell, but also how to control your cell, which is very important information. And if it gets damaged, the cell can't replace it, right? The cell is going to die. That's a really terrible thing for the cell. So I think of the nucleus as being a special little place in the library that we have next door. What do we have in the library that is analogous to the nucleus? But you might have to read my mind to know what I'm thinking. Okay. Is there a room in the library that contains very valuable information? Okay. And that information is so valuable that they don't let you take it out of the library. They let you use it, maybe inside the library, but not take it out. And I put your textbook in that particular little section of the library. What's it called? That's the reserve section of the library. Yeah, so the nucleus to me is like the reserve section of the library where very specific and important information can't be lost or corrupted. But if you want to use the information, can you? Yeah, you can go to the reserve section of the library, maybe make a photocopy of it, and after you make a photocopy of it, you can take it home with you, right? And if the dog eats the photocopy of that information, is that such a bad deal? Is the information lost forever? It's not, because you can always go back to the reserve section of the library and make a photocopy of it again, take it home. Okay, and hopefully this time the dog won't get it, right? All right, so that's really what the nucleus does. It protects very valuable information, but that information has to leave the nucleus and go into the cytoplasm to make a protein. So what we're talking about is protein synthesis. Some molecules are too large to move through the plasma membrane, so there are these pores within the nuclear membrane. So here you see a pore complex to allow large molecules, for instance, like RNA, okay, to move through the nucleus. All right, so I want to tell you something about protein synthesis. All right, so here is a nice little flow diagram that explains protein synthesis in its basic form, which is what I really want you to understand. Okay, so there is information that's contained in chromosomes. And chromosomes are made up of some proteins, but they're also made of nucleic acids. Right? And what kind of nucleic acids are you familiar with? There's DNA and RNA. Those are nucleic acids. Which are the kind that are inside the nucleus that makes up chromosomes? That's DNA, right? What's the building block of DNA? Those deoxyribonucleotides, okay? All right, so inside the nucleus you have DNA, and it stays inside the nucleus because that's where it's protected. If DNA were allowed to go into the cytoplasm, it could be corrupted. It's going to die. It's going to kill the cell. So, let me just ask you something about organelles inside the cell. Why do our cells have all these different kinds of organelles? What's the purpose of having all those specialized structures inside the cell? Yeah, to keep things alive. Okay, so I like to think of a cell as being modeled by, for instance, the SEM building right here. So when you walk in the SEM building, what do you see? Do you see one big auditorium, one big huge room, or what? A lot of different rooms, right? Why does this building have a lot of different rooms? Because, yeah, for instance, if it was just one big room, the dean would be doing his administrative work while I was giving a lecture, right? And there would be a physics lecture going on, there would be some experiments going on in chemistry, blowing up, right, making all kinds of smoke and things like that, glassware breaking. And what would those processes do to each other? They would interfere with each other, right? It seems like it would be a really good idea if you had SEM building with one room and you could take a physics class and a chemistry class, anatomy, physiology, micro, all at the same time because you could graduate in one semester. But would it work? No, all those classes would interfere with each other. So we put different rooms in a building so that vastly different processes can happen at exactly the same time without interfering with each other, right? So the same thing for organelles inside the cell. You got the mitochondria that's busy doing what? Making ATP. But it's not going to interfere with the Golgi apparatus, which is modifying and packaging, right? And that's not going to interfere with the SmoothieR, which is busy making lipids, right? So you have specialized structures to perform those specialized functions without interfering with other important functions inside the cell. And the function of the nucleus is to protect the DNA. Okay. So in order to make a protein, think of this central dogma of biology. Right? Information has to flow from DNA, which is its ultimate source of that information. Right? Information then flows into RNA. And then that RNA, the information in RNA, is used to make a protein. So when you look at protein synthesis, how many steps does it take? In other words, how many arrows do you see right there? You see two arrows. And what about those arrows? Are there pointy ends on both sides, or is it a one-way street? It's a one-way street. So protein synthesis, the best way to think of it is a two-step process, and that it's a one-way street. DNA directs the production of proteins. DNA in particular is found in the nucleus, so DNA in the nucleus is used to make a protein in the cytoplasm, okay? And that's a one-way street. And that's a really handy concept, right? Because a protein can't direct the production of RNA, and that can't ultimately then change who you are. Right, so that's a really good thing because tonight when you go home and have a chicken dinner, you don't have to worry about tomorrow waking up with a beak or feathers, right? Because those chicken proteins can't change who you are, all right? Because you are defined by DNA, and don't forget this is a one-way street. All right, so a dogma is just something that you should never challenge. You should just accept, right? Which is kind of contradictory to science because what should you do if you're a scientist? You should question everything, right? And you guys should too. Question authority all the time, right? Improve your understanding because that's how we get smarter. Okay. So these two steps right here have different names. This first step, converting information from DNA to RNA, where does that have to happen? It's got to be in the nucleus because DNA can never leave the nucleus. This is what we call transcription, right? The second step
All right, then RNA leaves the nucleus, it goes into the cytoplasm. This second step right here is what we call translation. And we're going to be really interested in these different processes in terms of controlling different processes with inside of a cell. And I want you to be familiar with these steps. All right, so pretend you can't question this. But eventually in your life, what are you going to have to do? Modify your understanding of this. And that will be important for treating various disease processes. All right, first process, DNA going into RNA. We call that transcription. Right, occurs in the nucleus, never in the cytoplasm. And there is a segment in DNA that we call a gene. It's a sequence of nucleotides that is a set of instructions for making one kind of protein. Right? And that has to be copied into RNA. Now, what does transcription mean? You might have to look that up in the dictionary, but you probably won't have to after we discuss it. What does transcription really, really mean? Yeah, like making a photocopy of something, right? So if you have a list of all the courses that you've taken at college and the grades, and somebody wants a copy of that, what are you going to do? You're going to make a photocopy. We call that a transcript. So a transcript really is an exact duplicate of that information. The information doesn't change. Nothing changes about it, right? You don't change the language or anything, exact same characters. All right. Now, the reason why we call that transcription is because what's the building block of DNA? The simplest one. It's a nucleotide, right? It's a deoxynucleotide for sure, deoxyribonucleotide. But think nucleotide. What's the building block of RNA? It's a nucleotide as well. All right, so the language of DNA is really the same as RNA. It's really just a duplicate copy. So that's why we call that transcription. Translation, on the other hand, all right, is a different kind of process. All right, and what the heck does translation really mean? What does translation mean? Anybody ever work as a translator? Probably. Some way or another. Okay. When you hear something in one language and then you pass it on to somebody else in what? A different language. But what about the information content? Should it change as you go from one language to another? Different language, different characters, looks totally different, but the meaning is exactly the same if the translator is doing their job. Okay. And we call this translation because what is the language of RNA? Or what's the building block of RNA? Nucleotide, what's the language of a protein or the building block of a protein? Amino acid. So they're different languages. But the information is the same. We're just using different languages to convey that information. Translation always happens in the cytoplasm, never inside the nucleus. And in particular, where does it take place? What do you have in the cytoplasm that can translate, that can actually take information in RNA and make a protein out of it? And it's that workbench, yeah, it's a ribosome, right? So that's why we say the ribosome is important for protein synthesis. More importantly, it's what? Not transcription, it is translation in particular, is what occurs in the cytoplasm. Where does transcription take place? In the nucleus, right? And that's the first step for protein synthesis. Okay. All right, so RNA is just a linear sequence of nucleotides, and a protein is just a linear sequence of amino acids. And you could think of that linear sequence as a way to spell a word. Right? What is a word made up of? Letters. And in order for you to make a word with the right kind of connotation or information or function, what can you do with those letters? Can you change them around? No. You got to spell it right. That was the bane of everybody in what? Anatomy. You had to learn spelling in anatomy, right? Because if you change the spelling, you change the meaning. And your instructor might not know what you're talking about, right? All right, so the sequence of nucleotides and the sequence of amino acids determine the proper structure and function of that protein. Okay. All right, so genes are lengths of DNA that have a proper sequence of nucleotides that code for the synthesis of RNA. One of the kinds of RNA is called messenger RNA that carries that information on how to make a protein from the nucleus into the cytoplasm. All right, so that's one kind. There's another kind of RNA that we talked about already, and it makes ribosomes. That's called rRNA or ribosomal RNA. That's the workbench that makes a protein. And that ribosome needs messenger RNA to make a protein, but it also needs another kind of RNA. So you should at least be aware that there's three important kinds of RNA. You got the rRNA that makes the ribosome. You got the messenger RNA that has the proper spelling on how to make the protein. And then, in order for a ribosome to actually make a protein, it needs the building blocks. What are the building blocks of a protein? Amino acids. And they're scattered all over the cell, so they have to find their way to the ribosome, so they hop on a taxi molecule. All right, and so we call that a tRNA. Not T for taxi necessarily, but T for what we call scientifically transfer RNA. So those are the three important RNAs: messenger, ribosomal, and transfer RNA. The job of transfer RNA is to bring amino acids to the ribosome so that it can use that amino acid to make a protein. Okay, we talked about this already, the two stages of gene expression. Okay, I said that the nucleolus, that dark spot inside the nucleus, that's the active part of the nucleus, it's making RNA. All right, so it looks a little dark. All right, a couple terms right here. The genome refers to all the genes that are contained within your chromosomes. All right, so you might have 50,000 different genes for making different kinds of proteins in your body. That's what we call the genome. And we're interested to know exactly what kind of genes you have and how many you have, if you're missing, are they mutated or whatever. So we're interested in everybody's genome now. The genome is responsible for making proteins. So all the possible proteins that all of the genes in your body can make are what we call the proteome. Right, so the proteome refers to all the proteins produced by the genome. And that's why you have genes, in order to make proteins. Right, so we're interested in knowing both of these things right here, both the genome and the proteome. Let's look at the structure a little bit more of DNA. Okay, so we see that it is a very long filamentous molecule made up of nucleotides. But DNA is what, single-stranded or double-stranded? It's double-stranded, okay, and you should remember the base pairing rules for DNA, and starting out by knowing what the nucleotides are in DNA. What are the nucleotides? I think we went over this. You've got adenine, thymine, uracil, and guanine and cytosine. Okay, so let me say it again. Rewind the tape. You've got adenine, thymine, cytosine, and guanine in DNA. And which two base pair? Let's just pick two first. What are the first two that base pair up? Adenine and thymine will base pair, and cytosine and guanine will base pair because they fit inside the double helix. Right? So, and then they have the right number of hydrogen bonds between them. All right, so the sequence of nucleotides right here will be used to spell out the sequence of amino acids to make a particular protein. So that information has to be protected, and the way it's protected is that DNA, this long filamentous molecule, is wrapped around proteins that we call histone molecules, and then they're packaged together and wrapped around some more to make this very dense DNA molecule. And under certain conditions, it can form this chromosome. So this chromatin over here is what we call extended. It's very vulnerable because it can break and fracture, right? But under certain circumstances, when the cell is dividing, this extended chromatin has to be packaged very carefully onto a chromosome, and we call that condensed chromatin, right? And these histone molecules are necessary to make these nucleosomes, right, that protects the DNA. So when the nuclear envelope is surrounding the DNA, it can be extended, but when the nuclear envelope disappears, the DNA has to be protected in this chromosome right here. All right, when, in what kind of process does the nuclear envelope disappear? When is it going to disappear? Does it ever disappear? During mitosis. Okay, and that's one of the last things we're going to look at in this chapter is mitosis. So that's why in mitosis we can see chromosomes, because it's a very nice way to protect DNA when it's packaged on all of these histones. Okay, I don't like euchromatin and heterochromatin. I kind of like extended chromatin and condensed. All right, so when do you have condensed chromatin? When you have a chromosome, you have extended chromatin when that information is being used. All right, so information can't be used when chromatin is condensed. It can only be used to make proteins when it is extended. The trade-off is when it's extended, the chromatin can be damaged. Right? When it's condensed, it's nice and safe, but it can't be used. So think of maybe you're taking a trip someplace. Okay? And when you go on a trip, what do? You just hop on an airplane with your wallet, or what do? Oh, you got a pack, you got maybe some luggage or whatever, right? So you got a hair dryer, you got your swimming trunks, you got your glasses, toothbrush, right? Or some shaving cream, okay, whatever you need. Pants, shirt, raincoat, right? Your swimming mask and a snorkel and I don't know what else, suntan, lotion. So do you get on a plane with all those hundreds of items in you're carrying in your arms? What do? With all that stuff? You put it in a bag, right? So you don't lose it. Okay. So when it's in the bag, you can't use it, but it's what? It's safe, it's protected, you can't lose it. But in order to use it, you got to take it out. And when you take it out, what can happen? You can lose it, like your sunglasses. You can leave them in the hotel room or something, right? So think of chromatin as being the same way. When it's packaged in a chromosome, it's real safe, but you can't use it. You have to extend it to make a protein, right? That first step is we call transcription, but when it's extended, it can be damaged. And when it's extended, it should always be behind the nuclear envelope, which helps protect the DNA. All right, so this is important control. All right, we have to extend chromatin from a condensed form, like when it's in a chromosome, to an extended form when it can be used. And there is a process called acetylation or acetylation. So there are different parts of the nucleosome right here, which are modified, which then extend the chromatin so that transcription can take place. And what is transcription? It's the first step of protein synthesis. It's the first step of protein synthesis. So before protein synthesis can take place, acetylation happens. So this is like the switch that allows transcription to take place. And after transcription takes place, these molecules are deacetylated, and the chromatin then starts to wrap up, forming these nucleosomes again, and it becomes protected, but then that also inactivates the DNA so that it can't be used. So this is like turning a light on. Turning a light on would be like what? Acetylation. Turning the light off would be like deacetylation. And an acetyl group, and we're going to find what it looks like in a little bit. It's just a two-carbon molecule. Like that, it's a very simple molecule that gets added to the nucleosome, and when it does, that nucleosome starts to unwind. So acetyl group is a two-carbon fragment. Okay. RNA synthesis. All right, so one gene codes for one polypeptide chain. And each gene is 7,000 nucleotide pairs long. So it's a really long molecule. Okay? But this polypeptide chain might itself be broken down into a number of different functional proteins inside your body. Okay, so how does this start? The first step is what we call transcription. Right, tell me what transcription does. It copies information from DNA to RNA. Okay? And there's a certain kind of enzyme that will allow that to happen. It's called an RNA polymerase. Anytime you see a word with an ASE on the end of it right here, Guess what that means? That has a connotation. Maybe not 100% of the time, but it's important nomenclature that you should know. ASC, if it's on the end of a word or the suffix of a word, means that it's an enzyme. It's going to perform some kind of function inside the body. And polymerase means, what's a polymer? A polymerase makes a polymer. A polymer is just a big, long molecule with repeating units, one after the other, after the other, after the other. As a matter of fact, you could think of a protein as a polymer, with the repeating units being what? What's the building block of a protein? Amino acids, one after the other, after the other. Right? You could think of DNA as being a polymer, one nucleotide after another, after another, after another. Right? And what about RNA? You could think of it as a polymer as well, okay, made up of ribonucleotides. All right, so RNA polymerase is an enzyme that makes this polymer, the RNA polymer. So what does it do? It looks at the DNA, and the DNA has how many strands? It's got two. In order to find the sequence of nucleotides, those strands have to unzip. All right, so it has to unzip, and is that a really difficult job, to unzip a DNA molecule? Because what kind of bonds are holding the two strands of DNA together? Hydrogen bonds, and is that a strong bond or a weak bond? It's a weak bond, so it can unzip very easy. There are regions in the DNA called promoter regions that regulate transcription, and then there are some other factors. And these could be even hormones, for instance, that act as transcription factors that have to bind to that promoter region to initiate transcription, which is that first step in protein synthesis. Okay, so first thing, the DNA has to unzip and unwind, and then a DNA, an RNA polymerase molecule binds to one strand of the DNA, and it's going to then follow base pairing rules to build a strand of RNA, which is this, well, to me it looks like light blue. Okay, so how does it know, right, to copy the correct spelling down? What's the general theory that we use to explain high fidelity in copying the spelling of the gene into RNA and then the correct spelling of RNA into making the proper protein? It is the base pairing rules. Right, so the strand of DNA right here is used as a template to make the RNA molecule. So here is the DNA, which is guanine. What base pairs with guanine? A cytosine. And what base pairs with cytosine? Here's a guanine. Now here is an adenine. Right, and this is where we have to perform that substitution. We don't have thymine in RNA, we have uracil. So a uracil is substituted in this position. All right, this one I can't see. All right, but here we have a guanine, we've got cytosine. So now you have the correct spelling in DNA transferred or transcribed into the correct spelling in the RNA molecule right here because of base pairing rules. All right, so when I look at this strand over here, how do I know this is DNA over here? Because we've got a thymine. And how do I know this is an RNA molecule? Well, because it's labeled, but also because there's a uracil right here. All right, so the enzyme that makes this RNA molecule is called what? RNA polymerase. And it can only bind to the gene when you have certain transcription factors binding to a promoter region some place on the DNA molecule. Okay, and then that process is going to stop when it reaches a stop sequence on the DNA molecule. It detaches, and then that RNA polymerase maybe can go back down to the start area and make another messenger RNA molecule. All right, so these are the three RNAs that we talked about already and their definitions. All right, but this one right here we really haven't talked about. Sometimes a messenger RNA molecule is made so that it can be modified into different forms inside the nucleus, and we call that a pre-messenger RNA molecule. All right, so let's take a look at this. Here we have a nucleic acid. How would you talk about this nucleic acid right here that's double-stranded? That's DNA, right? All right, and so it has to unzip first. RNA polymerase is going to come along and then use the base pairing rules to make a messenger RNA. And we see some light blue segments and some dark blue segments. Is that blue? Yeah, really good. Okay. All right, so here are three different light blue segments. These are segments that contain information on making a protein. So in our cells, these dark segments right here have to be spliced out. They've got to be chopped out. So these areas right here are what we call introns, and these light blue segments are what we call exons. Right? And after the introns are spliced out, the exons can be then spliced together to make the proper form of messenger RNA. Right? And I don't think we really know what the purpose of these introns are in our DNA yet. All right, so just think that they're thrown away. They might be used for some reason. If somebody is up on that, they could tell me or give me a reference to know that. All right, so this messenger RNA can be used to make a protein. But you know what? There's something else that can happen here. Maybe this exon can be thrown out, and this exon can be thrown out, and only this one in the middle is kept, which means that this can make a protein that is different from this one down here. And maybe the first exon can combine with the second one to make a different kind of protein. So here you have these different exons, right, coming from this one gene. So this just means that a number of different proteins can be made from this one gene in DNA, depending on how these exons are spliced together, right, which then is going to be used to make different kinds of proteins. So that explains why we have more possible proteins that can be made in the human body than we have genes, which means that the proteome is actually bigger than the genome because, right, these different exons can be spliced together in different ways to make different kinds of proteins. All right, so the human genome has about 25,000 genes, yet it can make 100,000 different kinds of proteins, right? And that is why, because RNA has to be split, the introns have to be taken out, and the exons can be put together in different ways to make different messenger RNAs, and we call that alternative splicing. You have a couple exercises at the end of the chapter where you actually have to calculate different kinds of proteins that are made from one kind of gene depending on how you put them together. But that's called alternative splicing. All right, so here we have a messenger RNA. It's a big, long RNA molecule, and that sequence of nucleotides is going to be used to put different amino acids together, right, to make a particular kind of protein. And each dot right here represents a ribosome. One messenger RNA, right, might actually bind numerous ribosomes that can all be making the same protein at the same time. Right, so here is just the beginning part of the protein, and you can see the protein is getting longer and longer and longer as this ribosome moves down the messenger RNA. So when we see a messenger RNA loaded up with ribosomes all making the same kind of protein, we call that a polysome. And we can see that underneath a light microscope. All right, so this probably is the most amazing slide in the whole class, at least in my opinion. Okay, so let's look at this slide right here. A ribosome has to read three messenger RNA bases to determine how to put an amino acid into the protein that's being made. All right, and that sequence of three amino acids is what we call a codon. So here we have DNA, the second column we have RNA, and then the third column right here is what we a list of amino acids. So here is a sequence of three nucleotides in DNA. So what is this sequence right here? It is thymine right next to, adenine right next to, cytosine. All right? What do we call that process of taking this sequence right here and converting it into the proper sequence in RNA? What do we call this step right here? That is transcription. And that is ruled by what? Base pairing rules. But of course, so what's going to base pair with thymine right here? Adenine, we see an adenine right there. All right, what's going to base pair with adenine in DNA? Well, if it's DNA, it's going to be thymine. But do we have thymine in RNA? No, we got uracil. So what's going to be placed in RNA is going to be a uracil, right? Transcribed into uracil. This cytosine is going to be transcribed into a guanine, okay, in RNA. So if you look at all of these triplets right here, it's going to define these triplets in the messenger RNA molecule. These triplets are what we call codons. All right. These codons determine what amino acids are going to be placed in the protein and in what position. This AUG is a start signal. This UAG is a stop sign that's going to be at the end of the gene. And if there's a codon that has UUU, what amino acid is going to be put into the protein at that location where you have, which is going to be the third position right here? That is, according to this, what we call the universal genetic code, it's going to be a phenylalanine. Okay? If you have a UCC, a serine amino acid is going to be put in that location. All right? And so as the ribosome moves down from this position to this one to this one to this one on a messenger RNA, then we have we have the proper sequence of amino acids that are going to be joined together to make a protein. What do we call that reaction when we put amino acids together? Yeah, that's called what? A dehydration synthesis reaction when amino acids get put together to make that nice peptide bond. All right. So now you have the proper spelling for this protein because you had the proper spelling for it in DNA. The first step is what we call transcription. Where does that take place? In the nucleus. What is the second step called? Translation, going from nucleotide language to an amino acid language. Where does translation take place? Cytoplasm, right? With the help of a ribosome. Okay. Now, this is why this is an amazing diagram right here. This is what we call the universal genetic code. So anytime you have an AAA as a codon existing in nature, right, whether you are a toad or a frog or a salamander or a chimpanzee or a human, or a bacteria, what amino acid is going to be put into the protein when there is an AAA on a messenger RNA? It's going to be a lysine. And so that's why it's called the universal genetic code. It works for all life forms. You don't need a different decoder ring for different kinds of living systems. And that can be used as evidence to support an important theory. And what is that important theory? If you're a biologist that you're interested in, and that is evolution, all right? Because all organisms use that same dictionary, the same genetic code. That is evidence that all life forms are what? Very, very similar and originated from some precursor way, way, way back when in history. And it's a very good system. It really never had to be improved upon. It works for all those organisms. Now, is that proof of evolution? No, it is just what? It's evidence of evolution. Yeah, it's evidence. It can be used as supporting evidence for evolution, but okay. So next time we're going to start, I think we got a couple slides left. All right, we'll start with this one right here. You might want to look over this slide. We'll talk about that when we start next time.